Hello and welcome to the Psychomedia Podcast. I'm Timothy Swan.
And I'm Ben Fell, and together we're going to be discussing the funny side of psychology.
Its funny side is awfully big, isn't it? You know,
well,
it's its best side, but it is a rather large one.
Its funny side is exactly proportional to the number of episodes we will eventually finish with.
Are you setting a deadline on this?
Well, our deadline is the sum total of funny things in psychology.
Yeah.
Which, like, logically must be a finite number.
Well, you say that, but research continues faster than we can record episodes.
That is true. It's like the expansion of the universe. But maybe the rate of research is slowing, so eventually we'll catch up with them. It's difficult to judge because we're kind of inside the research, so to us it just looks like it's just getting bigger.
Or however that works.
Can you say that in a Mancunian accent?
No.
Things can only get better. Actually, one of the things I was thinking in preparation for my comedy gig is that what I would quite like to do is perform the Craig David song Rewind in the style of Leonard Cohen.
I think that would be excellent. I cannot speak to your ability as a musical performer.
No, that's the trouble is. I had the confidence to do it when I was in the shower on my own. Well, obviously on my own, but...
Tim, you have a confidence to do a lot of things when you're in the shower on your own. And by you, I mean one.
Thank you. Because otherwise that sounded awfully creepy, as if it was referring to a past incident that went between us. Which I'm pretty sure didn't happen.
I'm pretty sure it didn't.
If it
you
did,
never
then
know.
We thoroughly repressed it.
Hooray for repression.
I mean, the most surprising thing is the lack of sexual tension between us.
Yeah, that is. I'm continually surprised.
We're in a strange mood, aren't we?
Yeah, we kind of are.
Well, there is
a reason for that.
Yeah,
we are in the future.
Yeah, we're recording it in a strange time bubble.
Yeah.
Last week I joked that I was a Time Lord and that one of my friends was also a Time Lord companion thing.
And this is exactly, turns out to be completely 100% not true.
What? But we're in a type of TARDIS.
We are. The TARDIS of recorded media.
A mental TARDIS.
Like the mental time travel.
Yeah, I was trying to get in a thing that referred to, you know... Anyway, it was an off-color joke, and I stepped back from it, because I am not Ricky Gervais.
Hooray!
Remember?
So yes, we are... Are we going to reveal the full methodology behind our crazy time travel, or just suffice to say that we're sort of in the future and sort of in the past? So, hello from last week, the future. I hope you are well.
And yes, which means that, weirdly, we've managed to get some feedback in our strange bubble.
Well, yeah, so as far as we're concerned, this is feedback that we are going to get. But as far as you're concerned, it's feedback that we have definitely had.
Yeah, we invented a predicting machine. we perfected the science of psychohistory, seen in Isaac Asimov's Foundation series. But instead of using it to predict the outcome of the human race and thus plan to preserve it, instead we used it to predict what people would say about us.
Of course. Why? What else would we do?
Well, of course, I was in charge of the project, so...
So, what will people have been saying about us, Tim?
Well, I have one in from James from the Monk in My Back podcast. It just says,
right.
Dave,
that's relatively
Dave,
predictable.
Dave, 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 oh. Dave, Dave,
oh,
Dave,
see.
Dave. Is that an Alan Partridge joke? Is it Dave or is it Steve or is it something like that?
No, it's Ben Fell. What do you think of it?
You were an Alan Partridge? Why didn't you tell me?
Well, Freud you, future Monkey on the Back podcast. I never liked future you. Never. I never will have. I will not have had future you.
I miss Douglas Adams. Can we use our time travel for better purposes? No. We
doesn't seem likely.
Have you had any feedback, Ben?
Well, yeah, actually, as a result of our shout-outs to the other podcast on the Peruvian... Was it Peruvian? No, Portuguese, sorry. On the Portuguese podcast page, we have actually had shout-outs from both the Chris Evans Show and the Lesbian Mafia. So, thanks, guys.
As in the Chris Evans Radio 2 Show, not just like something that the guy who plays Captain America does on his own.
Yeah, sorry. Well... Actually, it wasn't specific. you got it. So I'm kind of hopeful because okay. So the shout out for Chris Evans, the guy in Captain America, is love your work. Well done. You are almost as good as the Lesbian Mafia, who I will have listened to. And if it's the Chris Evans show, well done. Love your work. Kind of, not really. You're not as good as the Lesbian Mafia. So
I just remembered something, Ben. You know how I promised I would listen to the show Talking Questions?
Yes.
I did. It was quite like being on a lot of drugs. Very, very freeform, very random and surreal.
Okay. Well, that's kind of good. A bit like this, really.
Yeah, we're taking it out of their page.
Actually, Tim, I think, wasn't there one other bit of quite impressive in feedback that we wanted to talk about?
Yes, if I was being a satirist in about 2003, I would put up a poster saying, mission accomplished!
Yes, our predictive magical machine has found us a Chilean listener!
Hooray! yeah, I've got his name and his comment here, and the translation is just coming through from the Google Translate now, and it says, what is this? This is the most stupid podcast I have ever listened to, and the Spanish used by that incompetent Timothy Swan is absolutely terrible, and that guy Ben Fell is kind of all right.
That's nice. So what was his name?
It was Miguel Juan Sebastian Piñera Onchenique. So I'm going to stalk him. Because that's what we do to our listeners.
I'm sure I've heard that name somewhere. Isn't he the president of Chile?
Let me see. Sebastian Piñera, Wikipedia, born December 1st, 1949, a Chilean investor and politician. He was elected president of Chile in January 2010. Wow.
Oh, that's good. The president of Chile doesn't like our podcast, but quite likes me.
He has a very passive-aggressive smile on his Wikipedia page.
Take that, monkey on my back podcast. I bet he remembered my name as well.
I'll do the second bit. Google can only translate one bit at a time. It says, in response of your not taking our country seriously and just using us to try and get pole-to-pole dominance, I am sending some agents from the Agencia Nacional de Inteligencia. I can't imagine how you will pronounce this because I know you love reading out stuff verbatim on the podcast. I bet it will be a disgrace to the fine 125 who work for us, who are coming to kill you both.
Man, in the brief time between the last one we recorded and this one, we've been on Wikipedia a lot.
Oh, the amount of time I spent in Wikipedia over the last 2 weeks. Safe prediction.
Well, anyway.
Actually,
so
that reminds me of a joke that we used to tell. A joke that was definitely about the KGB and not about another intelligence agency of another country.
Well, that's now two of them that are on our tail. Anyway. So that was our predicted feedback. We've changed the dial on the machine. We've recalibrated it and reversed the polarity so that it will now tell us what things we will have done this week. This is not, I wasn't particularly pleased about the outcome of this because I, currently in the past really need to sort out the brakes on my bike. And it turns out that in the upcoming week, I will have fallen off my bike and died. So I'm currently recording this podcast from beyond the grave.
Can I ask you a quick question?
Yes.
Did you read my notes for this week or have you just done a really spooky thing?
I did not read your notes for this week.
Okay.
Well, obviously, it's the future, so I will have heard the podcast in the past.
Oh, no, that's really confusing.
Well, this is the thing, though. So it turns out I'm not in heaven, which is kind of bad. But apparently what happens, it transpires when you die, is that the neural signature of your brain merges with the nearest source of electromagnetic energy, which in my case was a wireless router in someone's house. So I'm now stuck on the internet, which means not only have I seen Tim's notes for this week, having access to Dropbox, but I have now watched all the films. So this renders all future podcasts somewhat null and void. But on average, I think I would probably give the entire corpus of human cinema about 5.5 out of 10 to annoy the statisticians.
Okay. Interestingly, you say all the films.
Yeah.
I mean, how is your skull doing? Because there's some pretty horrific films out there.
Well, it all fades to sort of grey noise after a while.
Grey noise. I bet that is a physics concept. There's pink noise, and there's brown noise, and there's white noise. There must be grey noise.
They're all sequels to the film White Noise.
Ah, thinking of sequels to the film White Noise, have you seen White Noise 2, The Light?
I haven't. Doesn't it have someone really famous in it? Or someone awesome in it?
It stars Katie Sackhoff, aka Starbuck, and Nathan Fillion.
I knew it
AKA
was that one.
Nathan Fillion.
I knew it. I need to see that film. It's so good. I need to see
it. It's like shockingly good, given that it's a sequel to a terrible horror film. What will I have done this week? I spent my time in a hermetically sealed chamber reading the Chronicles of Narnia in publication audio rather than fictional chronological audio, which is, I've never done it before. The numbers, obviously, on the spines have previously commanded me. No, I've read the whole of them, starting with The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, and ending in The Last Battle, because I'm going to be an extra new pod hussy in the future. Recording a podcast about Narnia. In theory, I'm supposed to be noting stuff down about leadership, but in actuality, my notes on post-it notes by my bed is just like things that I find vaguely interesting.
Ah, well, that is good. Actually, on that theme, one thing that I will have done before my untimely death is to read the new Terry Pratchett book, Snuff, which has just recently come out. As of the past recording in history, the book is actually sitting on my bed behind me. I bought it today. So
does that mean you can't actually reach it after you die? You've got to make sure you get it in before you die.
Well, yeah, I will have done.
Electrically, I suppose it will be like you can torrent it.
Yeah, but I'd feel
bad about
that. What happens
if you torrent something when you're a soul that's electronically connected to the web?
You get kind of a combination of vertigo and motion sickness, and a lot of porn. Quite a lot of porn.
I guess there's no way around that.
Really, there isn't. But anyway, so...
I do worry about what will happen to humanity when we do get the internet plug into our brain. Because I think it will happen.
Mainly,
probably in our lifetimes.
Mainly Rick Astley, I feel. but anyway, so I will have read Snuff. Actually, if at any point during this recording my line goes dead and I stop talking... that will be not that I will have fallen off my bike and died, but because the temptation will have become too great and I will have barricaded myself in my room and refused to come out till I finished it, which is how I traditionally read Terry Pratchett books.
Fair enough. I'm pretty much the same with key installments of the Star Wars Expanded Universe.
I think I win.
Yeah, you always win. I've watched some films.
Mm.
Every week, Ben watches a film, and I think, oh, I watched a film as well, but I won't talk about
it. And this week, you thought you were going to one-up me, but I watched all the films, so I won again.
Damn you, Squire! Did Squire just, like, lie on the road? Is that how you died?
Yeah, news from the future, Squire has been elected Pope.
Oh, that's interesting.
I know.
Certainly ties into our planned outro or something.
Out of left field.
What papal name has he taken? Is it the papal name Peter II that heralds the end of all things?
Pope Larry II.
Pope Lando II.
Oh, yes, of course. He is very traitorous. Anyway.
Lando. You know, no one has ever betrayed me since I watched that episode of Spaced. And I swore that the next person who betrayed me, I would say, you, Lando.
No one's betrayed. I'll have to betray you at some point.
Betray me for Christmas. That's what you
Yeah, I will betray you for Christmas. Okay.
Our relationship's messed up. Yeah, I watched the film Potiche, which is like a French comedy starring Catherine Deneuve, who is an old French actress, and Gérard Depardieu with a crazy haircut.
Because all French films star Gérard Depardieu.
And it's absolutely hilarious. It's so kind of surreal. It's set in an umbrella factory in the 1970s, and it's a bit like the film Made in Dagenham if it was a lot less serious and true.
And
Made in Dagenham is really funny and good, but this takes it like to a completely surreal next level, and it's absolutely hilarious. Also, French comedy, Little White Lies. The clue about Little White Lies is when something says it's a comedy drama, it means you're going to spend most of the time in tears.
Okay.
It's a very depressing film. It has some immensely hilarious moments, including, you know, Marion Cotillard being in it. And whenever I see a film with Marion Cotillard in, I'm just like, she's going to kill them all in order to escape her dream. Because every Marion Cotillard film is just like a thing that happened in one of the many levels of Down in Limbo in set.
Yes. I see. So, I guess that's what we will have done this week.
Hooray!
Which is cool. this podcast is following on from last week's topic, which is classic studies in brain science. Last week we talked about the strange case of Phineas Gage, a man with a head for tamping irons. and Tim
did
talked about
that joke and not fit it in.
Well, I kind of did. But yeah, and Tim also talked about Sperry and his split brain patients. So This week we are looking at two scientists named Pierre Paul Broca. That's right. Pierre Paul Broca and
Carl Wernicke,
who were sort of semi-contemporaries of each other. Broca generally comes first in the psychological histories for reasons which will become apparent. And they were studying actually around about the same time as Phineas Gage. I think Broca's first publication came out, or his first sort of case study emerged about a year after Phineas Gage's death. So in the 1860s, 70s, 80s.
Good. So we're getting some nice continuity there.
Yeah. And both of these guys are interested in brain damage, or are famous for research on brain damage causing language deficits. And
yes, indeed.
Severe language deficits. So, I guess, without further ado, I should just rock on with some stuff about Broca.
Yeah.
So, to begin, a little bit of a biography of Pierre Paul Broca. He was a French physician, anatomist, and anthropologist living in the mid-19th century. He's most famous for his contribution to our understanding of lateralization and localization of brain function, which we talked a lot about last week, how certain functions are specialized for the left or the right hemisphere, and how they can also be sort of specialized for particular areas within the brain, which up until his work was not really the accepted wisdom. In particular, what he is famous for is discovering the part of the brain responsible for speech production, which is a terribly general term and inaccurate, but that's kind of the cliff note heading of what he's famous for.
Sure.
The area, it was named after him. It's called Broca's area. It corresponds to...
So humble.
I know. I think it was possibly named that after you know, he talked about it.
Yeah, sure,
it corresponds to Brodmann areas 44 and 45, for those of you playing Brodmann Dingo. And I will talk about how he came to this discovery and the implications of it in a second. However, what I want to do first is say some of the other things that Broca did, because he wasn't just an anatomist and a neurologist. He was also an anthropologist, and he described what was, at the time, the earliest known case of trepanning. That is where primitive cultures would drill holes in people's skulls while they were still alive, and they survived the procedure to, you know, release evil spirits and things like this. I seem to recall it being a big theme in Philip Pullman's Northern Lights.
Although I don't think it was about the, you know, advantages on intercranial pressure.
Probably not. However,
shaman.
It's probably about angels, like most of that one. Jeez, Phil, get off your high horse about angels. Anyway, so he found that he described this in a skull from a Neolithic Incan cemetery.
What was he doing there?
Well, he wasn't in the Neolithic Incan cemetery. He was in France. There are parallels, I presume. But someone brought him the skull, and prior to which it was thought that the trepanning only emerged after, like, the time of the ancient Greeks. I don't know about you, Tim. I'd be quite sad if a Neolithic Peruvian tried to drill a hole in my skull. In fact, I think I'd probably be inconsolable.
See, the trouble with podcasts is that I can't just stare at you and judge you because it's dead air.
You can.
That's what I'm doing.
Well, I mean,
I'm staring at your face, but of course I'm not staring at your face because your Skype picture isn't your face, or is it?
Well, it might be. That's mean, Tim. I mean, I'm trying to make this podcast funny, and you're just being so inconsiderate.
Okay, the first time I groan and judge, the second time I laugh, I'm deeply inconsistent.
Excellent.
Well done.
Oh, that wasn't even deliberate. I swear to you, on the ghost of Sigmund, that was not planned.
Wow. I
have two planned jokes about Broker, but you'll know when I come to them.
Okay, well, that's enough of that. So anthropology, Incans, trepanning. The final thing, cool thing about Broker is he was a proponent of Darwin's theory of evolution, which was also sort of quite contemporary to him.
Yeah.
Apparently, biological evolution at the time was also known as transformism, which I thought was making prejudiced remarks about Optimus Prime, but apparently isn't. That's transformism. He's a proponent of this. This got him a lot of flack in 19th century France. His local church tried to have him struck from the electoral roll. And
serious business.
Yeah, at some point he founded a society of free thinkers who supported Darwin's ideas. And he was denounced for this as being a materialist, subversive, and corrupter of the youth, which means that he was essentially the 19th century equivalent of a gangster rapper.
Okay, I thought you were going to say it was a 19th century equivalent of Socrates, because that's what they got him for in the end, was corruptor of youth.
Well, he's clearly also a gangster rapper. So based on this, and because I had too much time during the preparation of this, I went on www.myrapname.com to see what Pierre Paul Broca's rap name would be. And apparently it's Paulie P, a.k.a. Immortal Daddy, which is it's pretty good. Incidentally, I don't know if you're interested, Tim, but your rap name... is Master Professor Timmy S. Roth.
Timmy S. Roth?
Yep. I like the Master Professor bit at the beginning.
That's
Master Professor
good.
Timmy S. Roth. Mine was Smug Benny B, a.k.a. Meaty Gunshot.
Meaty Gunshot?
Yep.
That's
and see if you can guess who this one was. Larry S. Dog, a.k.a. Sketchy Cobra.
Sketchy Cobra? Oh, someone put the snake in the scanner.
So, hopefully we'll link you to myrapname.com in the show notes. I had a wonderful time on there. Sigmund Freud doesn't work out quite so well because it can't really work out like abbreviating Sigmund.
Okay. Well, I might provide a link to, I think it's called Gizoogle.
Okay.
Which is the gangster version of Google. So if I just type in Paul Broker, it'll probably come out with something involving the N-word, but you know, we'll see what it says, and I'm not obviously going to say it. Loading.
Wow. The fact that the gangster rap version of Google actually has a loading time as opposed to Google, which knows what you're searching
Maybe
for before you search for it.
Like the Wikipedia. Ben, you carry on talking about Paul Broker. I will make this thing work.
Let's do this. Okay, so moving on from gangster rap for the time being. As I say, the thing that Paul Broker is most famous for is his contribution to the understanding of lateralization and localization of brain function, specifically localization of speech. And this work was all based on a particular patient Tan, who is Broca's most famous case. His real name was LeBourne. You might be familiar with this case. It was turned into a film in 2002. Have you seen it, Tim? It had Matt Damon in it. You know, LeBourne
Sure
Identity.
I've been reading my notes because that's the joke I wanted to make. LeBourne Identity.
LeBourne Identity. Yeah, I'm sorry. I think there. I mean, that is the obvious joke about Patient Tan. It's LeBourne Identity. You may be wondering why he was called Patient Tan when his name was LeBourne. So the circumstances surrounding him, he was brought to Pierre Paul Broca from a hospice in Paris where he'd been living. He'd suffered from epilepsy from a young age, as apparently all patients seem to, and he'd been living at the hospice for 21 years before Broca met him. The reason he was brought to Broca was because he had gangrene in his right leg, but this his most noticeable and peculiar characteristic was that he was unable to produce any speech other than the single syllable Tan, and this is why he was known as Patient Tan. He was referred to as Tan around the hospice. In fact, what he actually tended to say was Tan Tan, you know, to repeating the syllable twice. And this would be an answer to any question, often accompanied with gesticulations with one or both his hands. So, yeah, this is Patient Tan. And this is obviously a fascinating case. He can produce speech and he can apparently understand questions, but is unable to produce anything other than this stereotypical syllable. Broca also notes that Tan was able to produce a single swear word. When we were taught about Patient Tan, we were told that he could swear. And we therefore assumed that he could swear, like, lots of swear words. So you get the situation of, you know, anyway, yeah. He tended to swear when he was annoyed because people couldn't understand him, or frustrated, which apparently happened a lot. Apparently the single swear word, which Broca euphemistically described as a great swear word, with a capitalized great and a capitalized swear word. He only ever refers to it as the or a great swear word. And I think through some deduction, I've worked out that it was probably no longer a clean podcast imminently for the 19th century. Sacré Dieu. Or sacré Dieu.
As in sacred God?
Yes, apologize for my dreadful French accent. It's what has been corrupted to sacré bleu.
Oh, right.
Apparently, lots of words involving, like, sang de Dieu, which may also offend our French listeners. Apologies if all my French swearing in your language.
Isn't, like, most of the French profanity based on blasphemy rather than whatever the non-blasphemous, whereas, like, English swearing, it's all biological.
Well, apparently, like, at the time, pretty much all swearing was, like, even English swear words were like English things with God in them.
Right.
And they were all kind of corresponded to the French ones, so there probably was, like,
The only one I can remember is zounds.
Yeah.
Which is, like, an immensely offensive, blasphemous phrase, if you mean it, you know, obviously deliberately,
and yet,
because you're swearing by God's wounds.
Yeah, that's, so there was a French equivalent of that. But in a lot of cases, when they had, like, Dieu in them, they were, that was sort of changed to bleu, to be less offensive. So right. Sacré Dieu, Dieu, Sacré Dieu. Which is terribly, was terribly offensive, kind of reduced to sacré bleu. So yeah, Tan could only say tan and sacré Dieu.
Okay, well that's interesting.
Yeah,
I always thought, could it you reconstruct a language from the set of profanity? If you have, you know, the seven words you can't say on television, could you build a language out of them as sort of building blocks? Because there's a book where this is what a character does. A poet has brain damage and he's left only able to say, like, you know, profanity, but he's able to use it generatively and creatively.
Okay.
And eventually he builds it, and then it gives him a way back to getting his old language back.
Okay. Well, because,
but that's fiction, you know, so
so this may become relevant in a moment when I talk about some other patients who have subsequently been described who have similar conditions, because Broca, when sort of after he'd examined Tan and after Tan had died, he performed, you know, dissection of his brain to find out where, if there was any damage that might have caused it, and he kind of traced the degeneration in patient Tan's brain to find out where, you know, the various different problems that he had arose from. And what he came up with was this idea of a condition which is now known as Broca's aphasia.
Right.
Aphasia means a language deficit, essentially. And Broca's aphasia is also known as non-fluent aphasia, and is generally characterized as being a word-finding difficulty. So you know that feeling you get when you have a word on the tip of your tongue, but you can't quite find it. It's essentially that, just all the time. In less extreme cases of Broca's aphasia, patients can speak, but it's very labored. There's lots of ums and ahs and pauses and difficulties finding the precise words, and they have to use very kind of simplistic sentence structures or just like nouns to convey themselves. And then in more extreme cases, speech is almost completely arrested. So Broca also actually described a second patient called Lelong, who could say yes, no, three, and Lilu. So essentially, right. Bruce Willis in the film The Fifth Element, Lilu actually being like a corruption of his name, Lelong. So he had a similar condition. And there's also another one who you can find a video of on YouTube and various places called, I don't think he's called patient Tono, but the only syllable that he could say is Tono. So he can kind of articulate very well. So, you know, he has sort of pitch modulation and he's very expressive, but all he's saying is sort of Tono, 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 Tono.
Okay.
Fully expressive. The really crazy thing about patient Tono is when he, in the video, one of the videos you can see, he's asked to count from 1 to 10, having been asked loads of questions like sort of, who are your children, describe them, and being Tono, Tono, Tono. And when he's asked from count to count from 1 to 10, he goes 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 to Tono, 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 Tono. So it's kind of like after he gets out of like 1 to 11 or 12.
Yeah,
it's kind of not rote learned, so he has to.
That's interesting, because I guess that's when they stop being single words and start being kind of combined words.
Yeah, kind of. So very interesting. Anyway, this is Broca's aphasia. This is what Paul Broca is famous for describing in the case of patient Tan as being kind of the archetypal case of this, and it's significant because he was the first person to sort of localize a particular function to a particular area. This Broca's area, Brodmann area 44-45, which is in the temporal lobe, I think.
I think so, yeah.
The left temporal lobe. I should really have checked the exact location for the neuroscientists in the audience, but I didn't. So, ha.
Eat that. Not well, literally, no, you'll get Kuru.
You'll get Kuru, which is in fact a callback to last week's episode, but because
hooray, isn't it easy to do callbacks when you're using a time future predictor machine?
It is kind of handy. So that is not the end of the story of patient Tan and Paul Broca.
Is it going to get sad?
Well, hopefully sad and then unsad. So patient Tan is actually quite a sad case. You know, when we were talking about Phineas Gage, you know, he lived a relatively, you know, full and rich life. After his accident, patient Tan, you know, had been in a hospice for 21 years before Broca found him, and he didn't live much longer after this. He was brought to Broca for gangrene in his leg, and apparently he wasn't a very nice person. He was apparently egotistical, vindictive, and was accused of being a thief by people in the hospice. Which meant that the other patients and doctors kind of ignored him. And apparently, you know, like he was bedridden towards the end of his life because the kind of the paralysis and gangrene in his right arm and leg extended to one whole side of his body. The other patients like would amuse themselves at his expense, and his clothes were only changed like once a week. So it's really quite,
that is not the picture I had of him.
No. I mean, when we were first introduced to him, we only got like the very bare essentials of, you know, a guy who could only say Tan and swear words. And the idea of, you know, conversing using only a single syllable and swear words was amusing to us. And as was, you kind of feel pretty bad when you read about all these cases that you've sort of found conceptually amusing the first time round.
Yeah.
Always read the details of these cases and try not to laugh at them quite as much as we've been doing.
Yes.
So, yes, psychology is not funny.
That's the take-home message from every episode.
So, in this next, the final section, I just want to talk about how it is funny.
Okay, good.
So, Tan was characterized as having Broca's aphasia, and he's always characterized as having Broca's aphasia, and Broca's aphasia is this word-finding difficulty. However, there is an article by Ola Sain and Argai Hillis, probably not pronouncing any of those names right, but a recent article in let me just check. Yeah, it's 2000. Yeah, in published in 2000, where they were suggesting that maybe modern, in terms of what we would modern nowadays diagnose as Broca's aphasia, is not what Patient Tan actually had. The article is called "Patient Tan Revisited: A Case of Atypical Global Aphasia." And they base this on following points. So, Patient Tan is obviously very famous for having these stereotypical utterances, i.e. only being able to produce one particular word. Apparently, this is actually quite relatively rare in modern cases of patients with Broca's aphasia. It only generally occurs if the patient started off having something called global aphasia, which means that they not only do they have kind of the extremely limited speech production, but they can't do repetition, they can't do naming, they have very poor comprehension. It's just sort of like complete language failure. Where you find Broca's aphasics with stereotyped utterances is when they have previously had global aphasia as a result of, say, a stroke, and then they've recovered some of their language ability, so their comprehension, for example, but they still remain non-fluent and have these stereotyped utterances. So that is an inconsistency. The second thing is Tan's level of comprehension. So generally, it's assumed that comprehension in Broca's aphasics is good. They tend to have like problem with syntactically complex sentences, like the fencing foil received by the patient to the face was wielded by a comedically misguided neuroscientist. They would probably have difficulty with that sentence. But like, the scientist stabbed the cadaver would probably be fine for them. The problem is with Patient Tan is that Broca didn't really use very detailed or taxing comprehension tests. I mean, he basically, it's not much more than how many fingers am I holding up, which is, you know, trivially easily. I mean, Tim, how many fingers am I holding up?
Is it two and it's the V's?
Well, no. hang on, we'll try it again. How many fingers am I holding up now?
Is it three, upside down, the universal symbol for milk?
Okay, no. Tim, I don't wish to alarm you, but I think you might have Broca's aphasia.
Tan?
Oh, I was banking on you saying that. okay, so, finally. The comprehension is difficulty is somewhat inconsistent. Finally, the actual specific area that we today know as Broca's area is not actually exactly the same as where Patient Tan had brain damage.
How did we mess up over the years?
Well, yeah, exactly. So although damage to Broca's area, as we now know it, causes speech disruption, it doesn't usually produce the complete loss of speech seen in Patient Tan, as I mentioned with the global aphasia thing. So, Sain and Hillis argue, it's possible that Tan actually had what we'd call global aphasia. But, again, this inconsistency is not due to any error on Broca's part or anything. It's actually due to the fact that our definition of Broca's aphasia has changed over the years. So, in summary, I understand this can be quite confusing. I'll summarize it simply for you. Basically, Broca's aphasia is not exactly the same as the aphasia Broca described, because the aphasia described by Broca was actually closer to global rather than Broca's aphasia. Damage to Broca's area causes Broca's aphasia, but the area described by Broca is not the same as Broca's area, just as the aphasia described by Broca is not the same as Broca's aphasia. However, when Broca was describing the damage to the area, there was no such thing as global aphasia, so he's right to call it Broca's aphasia and the area Broca's area. Now we know that Broca's area isn't the area where Broca said it was, and Broca's aphasia isn't the same aphasia that Broca said it was. In conclusion, modern scientists have clearly never heard of the saying, if it ain't Broca, don't fix it.
Oh,
zing!
Okay, is that all you'd like to say about Broca?
I think that's all that needs to be said.
Okay,
probably all.
Can I just say one thing? I found a gangster translation.
Oh, good.
This will be profoundly wrong, so I'm going to do it in my poshest English accent.
That's probably for the best.
This is a quick biography. Yo, Pierre Paul Broca has been referred to as brilliant neurologist, surgeon, and anthropologist, a child prodigy, and a N-word well ahead of his time. He was born in Da Township of Sainte-Foy-la-Grande in Da Dordogne region of France in 1824. He entered medical school when he was 17 years old and graduated by the age of 20 from Hotel Dieu in Paris. Broca became early a professor of surgical pathology at the Université de Paris and a well-known medical researcher in many areas. He held degrees in mathematics, literature, and physics. His early scientific work focused on the histology of cartilage and bone, the treatment of aneurysms, infant mortality, and cancer pathology. Also, a fly brain anatomist, he made contributions to understanding the limbic system. Broca was also responsibility for his discovery of the speech center, known this day as Broca's area. He studied the brain of aphasic patients, which was N-words, who was unable to jive. The most well-known N-word he studied was the first patient at the Bicetre Hospital named Tan, who had a neurosyphilitic lesion in one side of the brain, which controlled speech slap ma frol. Well, that was hideous.
That was quite upsetting. Although Broca's aphasia is N-words who are unable to jive. That is actually in the DSM-5.
The campaign starts here. Although maybe we shouldn't be the faces of this campaign.
Let's not be the voices of this campaign.
All right. Let's go to the other half of aphasia, sort of. And that,
we're crossing the corpus callosum of language.
Yeah, only no, that's unhelpful, because it's on the same side of the brain.
Utterly
Don't
unhelpful.
Confuse our listeners. Apart from sexually. Karl Wernicke, who was German, in case you couldn't tell from the name, it's quite interesting to have the kind of Franco-German interrelation at this time in history, when obviously they were having quite a lot of the whole fighting thing. Wernicke followed up the work of Broca by studying a patient with a very different speech disorder to patient Tan and those who have been called Broca's aphasia in the present, known as fluent aphasia or receptive aphasia, or most obviously Wernicke's aphasia. Actually, another offensive thing I wanted to do while we're talking about offensive things was I wanted to do aphasia panel games. Where you'd be given a card with the particular aphasia on, and you had to speak as if it were that, and then the other person had to guess which aphasia you had. It would probably be really easy. I'm just like, that
it would be good revision, wouldn't it? I might try that with the psychologists in college next time we get together for pizza.
Okay, but with Wernicke's aphasia, there are two key failures. The part that makes it receptive aphasia is that they can't comprehend what's said to them. And the part that makes it fluent aphasia is that they can produce perfectly grammatical and syntactical speech, but it lacks a certain something, and that certain something is meaningful content. So I managed to find a quote here, which is one that we actually did during our degree. I refound it again. Clearly, there's not that many examples. And it goes, again, reading things out. Hooray! Well, this is, mother is away here working her work out of here to get her better. But when she's looking, the two boys looking another part. One, their small tile into her time here. She's working another time because she's getting two. And it sounds meaningful. And actually, this particular example comes from asking a fellow with fluent aphasia to describe this cartoon scene of a pair of kids trying to steal a cookie while their mother's back is turned.
And so it kind of... It sort of makes sense, but only if you know what it's supposed to be describing.
Yeah, which...
So it's kind of like Babelfish or Google Translate.
Yeah, I was thinking it's like those spam emails you get with the fake content to make it look like a real email. And then you look and it's like, oh, wait, this isn't quite right. So if you do a bit more concrete test of ability than asking people to describe a cartoon... they show that the comprehension is far more impaired than those with Broca's aphasia. I mean, you mentioned the confusion with some grammar. That is like pretty minor when you compare it, because you can't rephrase something so a Wernicke's patient will understand it. The speech is sometimes called cocktail hour speech. I'd quite like to know what a cocktail hour is. I mean, I can probably work it out. It's a bit like a happy hour for the middle or upper class. And indeed, that's quite fitting, because the other condition that Wernicke discovered was Wernicke-Korsakoff syndrome, which is a memory disorder that's found in extreme alcoholics due to it leading in general to thiamine deficiency. And actually, sometimes I feel when I'm tired and not especially concentrating that other people's speech is a bit vernacry. You know, there's plenty of words in it that seem like they're in the right order, but I have absolutely no idea what they mean.
I have that in lectures sometimes as well. It's quite common.
Yeah, lectures are very common place to feel that. Meetings, I imagine, if you've, you know, a worker or whatever. Also, they when they do speak, if they get close to making sense, because obviously you can have a range of severity, they contain paraphrasias, which is where you sub in a word for words of a similar meaning, words that have similar sounds, and then similarly spelt but made up words. I actually get problems with similar sounded words, but only for given names. I have great difficulty remembering the difference between Joseph Gordon-Levitt and Jennifer Love Hewitt. And one that my mother was agreeing was fair enough was Stephen Sondheim and Steven Soderbergh.
Okay. And yeah, I can see how that works.
I'm not sure it's that uncommon.
I'm not sure why, and this is probably utterly irrelevant, but I have great difficulty remembering the difference between November and February. They're
kind of parallel months.
Well, it's almost like if I were a synesthete, as in if I like saw colours for months of the year, they would be like really similar in color. Like they're
what color?
We should do one on synesthesia at some point.
Yeah, because we know a synesthete, a really weird one as well.
Yeah, so Ramachandran actually talks a lot about synesthesia, we deemed the stuff that he'd mentioned slightly less amazing and funny than the other stuff, despite the fact that synesthesia itself is a fascinatingly amazing thing.
Yeah, I'm sure we've still got the actual journal articles around somewhere in our great archive in the sky. So another thing that Wernicke's aphasics have is press of speech, which is where they speak really quickly, as if they're desperate to get out as much as they can because they'll get a sense of closure. It says they patients may speak very rapidly, interrupting others. It may seem as though the patient is striving for a sense of closure or a sense that he has communicated what he intended to say.
Again, like Mock the Week.
Yeah, true. And, if you ever listen to the things that Frankie Boyle actually said, it turns out that he has no idea what he's talking about. Here's a quote here from someone who studied Wernicke's about their abilities to communicate that do remain. Wernicke's patients' ability to communicate their thoughts, needs, and wishes is significantly better, sometimes approaching normal, using non-verbal means such as actions, movements, props, gestures, facial expressions, and affect than verbally. Which is
I'm so glad that you made a mistake in that sentence because you said like props, actions, and gestures.
Did I?
Yes. So I think that probably is quite a good way. Each Wernicke's patient needs to have a guy in motley with bells on his hat who will, through the medium of comedic interpretive dance, convey what he wishes to convey.
Yeah. And for example, when standing in a cafeteria line with choices of fish or pasta, a Wernicke's patient will shake his head no when the cafeteria staff tries to put fish on his tray, though not answer coherently with words when asked if he wanted the fish, and then he'll point to the pasta. Similarly, we have seen Wernicke's patients, upon egress from a clinic appointment, walk correctly into the elevator, press correctly the up or down button, get out of the way of people exiting the elevator, exchange normal non-verbal pleasantries with the other elevator users, and press the button correctly for the floor to which they wouldn't want to go. When another person waiting for the elevator would try to speak with the patient, there was no effective or even coherent conversation. I copied that out of an article. Microsoft somehow managed to forget that floor and fish were words. I managed to give Microsoft Word aphasia.
Who knew? It's actually a catching disease. Just it is only transferred between articles and Microsoft Word.
It's the weirdest thing. I'm just like, that's so cool / really annoying. Yeah. So Wernicke is the person who discovered it. Wernicke himself has an interesting history. He was obsessed with his first teacher. I've copied a bit out of just biography. Maynard, who was his first teacher, influenced him greatly. And Maynard was virtually the only name Wernicke mentioned in his lectures, and only his portrait hung on the wall in Wernicke's clinic.
Wow.
It's kind of obsession. I mean, you don't often see an obsession to the extent that someone is the only person mentioned in lectures.
Well, you do, but it's usually themselves.
Exactly. Yes, indeed. He was also taught by Carl Westphal,
who discovered agoraphobia, which is good, and was the first person to clinicalize homosexuality, which is less good. You know,
that is less good.
Win some, lose some. And
positive and negative contributions.
Wernicke was only 26 when he had his work on aphasia published, which is slightly less depressing than Ramachandran, but not by much.
Still, yeah. Okay, we've got a few years.
Now, Wernicke became a world-famous neurologist within his lifetime, but really weirdly, it was not for his work on Wernicke's aphasia.
Really?
It was for his work on the link between the sixth cranial nerve and eye paralysis.
Huh, that old study.
Yeah, I know. I mean, it's always totally the minor stuff that gets the fame. You know that Lady Gaga was a pioneering member of a Lord's Crossbench Committee on Privacy.
Really?
Yeah.
Was that before or after she was a go-go dancer? Or possibly during?
It was when she still has a secret identity as an Italian-American from New York. But yeah, so Wernicke was one of the first people to believe that different mental conditions stemmed from different brain damage, which is in a sense right, although only for ones of brain damage origins, I suppose. And he really opposed the first ever description of schizophrenia, you know, Kraepelin.
Oh, yeah, yeah. The, what was it called?
Dementia praecox.
Praecox, yeah, that was the one.
And Wernicke was just like, that is not a scientific enough definition.
Mm.
Which is fair enough. The problems of schizophrenia do come from it being a bit all-inclusive.
Mm.
But his enemies described him as a brain mythologist. It's quite a
good That sounds one. Brilliant. This week in Brain Mythology 101, we will be studying the brain of the Cyclops.
Well, maybe that's what we should do next week, is some mythical and magical psychology that actually then turns out not to be a myth.
It's kind of like, well, yeah, that would work. Or the alternative to do like alternative history psychology.
Oh, like, yeah.
What would a Cyclops' brain look like? Well, it wouldn't have the crossover at the lateral geniculate nucleus. And
Actually, it wouldn't be that different because it's done by visual fields. And a Cyclops still has the same visual fields.
It would only be like early visual cortex and subcortical visual areas that would change.
Yeah, I mean, it would actually solve a good number of problems in perception.
Nerd points.
Because stereoscopy is such a bone of contention in perception.
Yeah.
And stereoscopy can only come when you have two eyes.
But, I mean, they would have depth perception, but only from, like, visual cues like motion parallax and stuff.
Exactly. That's the thing. He didn't swing his head around enough, and that's how Odysseus managed to stick him with the thing.
Yeah.
He thought that the stick was way away. See, we're slowly bringing the classicists back. The biography of Wernicke concludes that Wernicke was a taciturn and reserved man, not easy to deal with. Now, if his biography says that, can you imagine how bad he really was?
Wow, yeah. I'm inclined to go along with his I like how you describe them as enemies, who call him
a brain mythologist.
Brain mythologist, yeah.
But yeah, I just think that maybe it was just like, by comparison to his patients, he seemed taciturn, but not easy to get along with. Anyway, so the actual work of Wernicke, it established a lot of things for the first time. The first time it established hemispherical dominance. I always find that a bit weird, that my left hemisphere is kind of the boss of me. Or worse, you know, like there's this dominant submissive relationship between my hemispheres.
Are you left or right-handed?
Right-handed, just about. Uh-huh. But no, if you've seen me right with my left hand, you'll know that it's horrifically bad.
Okay.
You know, it's a bit like the special relationship, except that losing the right hemisphere would cause some problems for the left hemisphere, as we learned a couple of weeks back, whereas I think the USA can live without us. Anyway, the difference between sober discourse and insane runaway narratives fit our political systems quite well.
Sober if hesitant discourse. Labored, extremely labored.
Labored, it's funny because there's a Labour Party.
It is objectively funny. The best kind of funny.
Wernicke was sent a patient with a stroke. And again, I mean, like patient Dan, that was probably major brain damage. Not just, major effect, but really broad brain damage. The man could speak. His hearing wasn't damaged, per se, so I think that shows that Wernicke did test it on non-speech stuff, and what it shows up is that they're actually fine on non-speech recognition, if you click your fingers or make a noise or something.
Yeah.
But what really amazed Wernicke, and anyone who read what Wernicke wrote, is that the aphasia applied across spoken and written language.
Oh, really?
And so it proved for the first time that language existed as a thing in the brain that wasn't just the writing part and the speaking part. Broca had shown that clearly a part of the brain is responsible for language, but it was just spoken language. I mean, I don't know. Could Patient Tan write just fine?
Well, this is the problem.
Or was he illiterate?
He had paralysis in the later stages of his life. So I have actually in Broca's the translation of Broca's original notes.
Right.
Yeah, I think he could move his hands, but I don't think
motor control. Right. Theoretically, he would have been able to write, I think.
Yeah. You would have to check more recent and better described Broca's aphasics.
Yeah. Genuine Broca's aphasics. But yeah, so Wernicke couldn't actually help the guy, so he waited for him to die.
Standard 19th century, you know.
It's like, oh, that's a very fascinating condition you have. Do a quick behavioural experiment. Can't provide any treatment for you at the present day, so see you in about 5 years when you're dead. I don't know why I talk like Wernicke.
Let's go for a walk along this windy cliff.
You wouldn't want to push them off a cliff. Come on, Ben. You never murdered someone so you can study their brain?
I'm just not as good at it. It just goes everywhere.
See, neuroscientists are lovely. But yeah, Wernicke's area is not especially well defined, but it's sort of, if you're doing the Brodmann bingo, it's areas 42 and 21, which are areas surrounding the primary auditory cortex. So it's a type of sensory association cortex where you pull in real low-level sense data and plug it into some of the other information sources from around the brain. Apparently, that's what association cortexes do. So Wernicke believed it was this seat of understanding language, and that in there were what he called word images that were a cross-modal thing that went across written and spoken language, but that somewhere in there were represented the genuine neurological analogues of individual words. And we'll have to come back to language because, you know, there's been some work on that, obviously, since Wernicke. And it's backed up quite well because patients with Wernicke's aphasia who were sign language speakers show it just the same, even though their method of expression is very different to speaking or writing. Interestingly, also, profanity does remain, just as with Patient Tan, although it's not clear how it's used.
Yeah, it's kind of like it's weird that profanity always seems to crop up as being like the strange exception.
Yeah.
And you kind of wonder why that might be.
Yeah. I imagine
probably there's been some work on it. We should look it up.
Yeah. I imagine
I'll add it to the list.
It's a much more reflexive response and it would tie into the limbic
system. An emotive.
Yeah. Certainly I've seen suggestion that it does have an emotional impact.
Mm.
But so he wrote a book having done this study. Dissections and the rest of it, and he really pushed for localization of function, the different bits of the brain do different thing, which wasn't really that well proven at the time. There had only really been Broca saying that,
and so his ideas were very much kind of in their infancy, and some people agreed with him, some people didn't.
Some people thought that like the brain is a mass that does thinking, so if you cut out 10% you'll be 10% less clever. And so that was the suggestion. Another thing he did is he predicted conduction aphasia.
Yes. This is excellent, you know, good experimental science in action.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's impressive by Wernicke. He predicted that there would be a less severe aphasia where one could speak quite well and understand just fine. But when they made mistakes, unlike in Wernicke's or Broca's, they would spot them, but they would have a great difficulty in trying to fix them.
So basically the idea of this was he took Broca's aphasia and the localization of Broca's area and his own work on Wernicke's aphasia and essentially hypothesized that there must be kind of connections between the two areas to allow speech to happen. And therefore, that if there was damage to these connections, as opposed to either of the two areas, you would get a particular kind of behavioral outcome.
Yeah, and it exists. And the amazing thing is that it's the first time anyone had suggested this circuit idea. Because even if you get to the localization of function, I mean, that comes out in the pseudoscience of phrenology.
Yeah. which was still at least kind of, there were sort of echoes of that hanging around and getting in the way. This whole idea of like, the bigger the brain, the more intelligent. And if you lost aspects of the brain, then it kind of, you'd get less clever. It's sort of a vaguely has aspects of phrenology about it.
Yeah. But nowadays, everything is based on a circuit model. So we might say, oh, the amygdala is the bit related to emotion. And what we really mean to say is that there is a circuit from the amygdala to the cingulate cortex that is often involved in negative emotion. And that's a really simple one. Everything, obviously, is interconnected. But Wernicke was the first person to really get that. So, you know, I think that's really impressive. Conduction aphasia is quite interesting. What he didn't predict, but it turns out, is that they have difficulty repeating phrases exactly. And non-words and pseudo-words, which are made-up words. Non-words are made-up words where the letters don't make any sense. Whereas pseudo-words look like they could be plausible words, because they make kind of sense phonetically, but they aren't real words. And they can't do those at all. So if I said to someone with conduction aphasia, repeat after me, the truck spilt its load on the highway, they'd say to me, the lorry lost its goods on the motorway. And not just because they're obstinately British, but because they can get the meaning and they can kind of push the meaning through, but they can't preserve the actual words it was said in. And when they do make a mistake, they have to do the kind of this extreme, frustrating trial and error to get to the right answer. So if you ask them to say the word Rosenkranz, and this is a German speaker, they asked, otherwise it would be a bit harsh. The guy's like, he's like, Rosenbrau, no, Rosenbrauch, no, Rosengrau, no, bro, no, Grosenbrau, no, Grossenlau, no, Rosenkranz, Kranz, Rosenkranz, got it.
Yeah.
And Wernicke believed that this conduction was due to a white matter connection, you know, another big one like the corpus callosum, called the arcuate fasciculus. And it's probably not, apparently, but it's still the prediction of the model, even if he didn't get the precise brain bit right, was right on. And so
I think apparently he predicted, not necessarily unreasonably, kind of basically he just drew a line between Broca's area and Wernicke's area and said, well, if you cut the bit in the middle, then it'll go. Whereas in actual case, the arcuate fasciculus kind of loops.
I'm sure
roundabout way,
if you could divide the brain up and found the proper connections between the two, that would be the thing. And actually, conduction aphasia was studied by one of our great nemesis and foes, Sigmund. Now, he suggested that conduction aphasia was actually the most significant aphasia and the most severe language breakdown for some reason. And he predicted that the inner monologue would be destroyed in conduction aphasia. And actually, work has found that they still have an inner monologue. They would probably have difficulty expressing that inner monologue properly. But it's...
See, Sigmund, he's just like, he's so rubbish. Never gets anything right. Come on, Sigmund.
And so, Freud...
Pull yourself together.
Freud was arguing for that the whole language system from Broca and Wernicke, it was all one undifferentiated system that all did exactly the same thing.
Right.
So to put that in terms we've already talked about, he was the squire of his day.
Damn you, squire!
I'm so glad I managed to prove the two are analogous. But yeah.
It's taken us 8/9/7 episodes, but we have finally proved that squire equals Freud.
Hooray! We've destroyed maths. Anyway, so yeah, some more recent research on Wernicke's area. A fellow called Harpaz did a process called TMS on the right-hand version of Wernicke's area, because Wernicke's area, again, left-hand side, because that's the side that deals with language. TMS, transcranial magnetic stimulation. It's amazing, isn't it?
It's wonderful. You get a powerful electromagnet, or occasionally a couple of powerful electromagnets, and you run a large, current through them so that they produce a large magnetic field, and then you hold it over an area of someone's brain, and the magnetic field from this magnet interferes with the electrical function of the neurons in the brain, depending on, as physicists would tell you, like the way you orient the coils of the magnet and the orientation of the neurons in the brain, because obviously the brain is kind of folded and lumpy, so different neurons are in different orientations. And you can do various things with TMS. It's most famous for being able to produce what are called temporary lesions, which is where you sort of disrupt the function of neurons in the brain. And in healthy volunteers, you knock out a small brain area. So, for example, you can get people to kind of raise their finger on a table, and then you TMS the motor cortex area corresponding to the fingers, and they won't be able to do it.
You can make people blind.
You can make people blind. You can make people see stars, or phosphemes, as they're called. You can also do the reverse, which is like induction. So you can cause someone to twitch their finger, or apparently one of the side effects of TMS, especially if it's over frontal areas, is you can make people really sad.
Oh, really?
Which is one, like, on the hazard list for TMS is like, warning, coils can become hot, can cause scalp burning, electric currents involved, you know. Warning, if over frontal areas, can cause depression.
Terrific.
Which is kind of fun.
Yeah. The first thing that we thought when we first heard about this process was, can we weaponize it? Can we replace the taser and invent a non-lethal weapon that knocks out people's legs?
we kind of worked on this idea for a while and decided that the problem with TMS is that it's actually quite accurate. I mean, you can knock out an area as small as relatively precisely about a centimeter, but this is with the coil pressed against someone's head, so you'd probably need like a 20 Tesla magnet focused on a different place.
I don't believe any exist yet,
probably except in like the biggest MRI machines, which are like
eight, aren't they?
Yeah, super cooled. There's a 7 Tesla one in Oxford, which is one of the biggest that's used for that purpose. So that would be tricky. Aiming it would be really hard. You need a well established knowledge of neuroanatomy in order to be able to like accurately target, yeah, I don't know, someone's speech centers.
If you got it wrong, you might hit like the brainstem or something. There's not that many super important parts that are exposed enough on the surface to do it, but the brainstem at the back.
I suppose if you're weaponizing it, you're probably not that concerned.
You don't want to kill them. The whole point was it's a non-lethal weapon. But yeah.
Which is a very poor sequel.
Yeah. Well, they used the induction method of TMS on the right hemisphere, and they found that what it seemed to do was identify the less significant meanings of words. So if you presented an ambiguous word, it would trigger different meanings if you stimulated the left and the right side. So if I said bank, if you triggered the left side, the word that they would say would be money. And if you inducted activity in the right side, they would say river.
Yeah.
And so I thought that was really amazing, that it's like all the important words are in the left Wernicke's area and all of the less important words are in the right Wernicke's area.
Which also sort of makes sense in a way if you think about the idea that the right hemisphere is involved in things like humor and metaphor.
Yeah.
Because so much of humor is about kind of reversal of expectations, and metaphors are about like double meanings of words and associations with them. Yeah, so yeah.
Absolutely. And indeed, that there is a type of aphasia called anomia, where you lose the ability to use certain words, and rarer words are better preserved and easier to define. So it might be that there's left damage there and not right damage. And so you might lose the word goose and keep the word constitutionally. I think that was something like that in the examples. We focus on it.
Some random.
But yeah, so, you know, the final question is, what can be done about it? Wernicke didn't know. He just waited for the guy to die. But there have been things that have been tried. One of them is called MIT. It doesn't involve sending people with aphasia to
this.
The Massachusetts Institute of Technology. It's musical intonation therapy. Okay.
I love it.
I mean, yeah, it's apparently more effective in Broca's, but it can work in Wernicke's. What you do is you turn key phrases into little song jingles. And so that helps the right hemisphere take over language because it combines it with something it already does, music.
I'm sure this happened in an episode of House.
Oh, really?
I'm pretty sure.
Are you sure it wasn't an episode of Scrubs? You know, the musical episode. no, obviously that's the opposite. It's all very operatic. You sing phrases. And then once you've taught them to sing it, you teach them to just say it in a melodic rhythm, which is apparently something that Wagner invented.
Okay. That renowned psychologist.
Oh yeah, he was a great guy. And by great guy I mean a pretty mixed up guy, a good musician with some dubious views. But yeah, so
you know, it works in some cases of Wernicke, but it's not really tailored to it. So what about something a little more tailored to Wernicke? Apparently what you should do is get patients to make the most of their non-verbal skills so that they can be able to communicate really fluently in hand gestures and the rest of it, rather than trying to restore spoken language in speech therapy. And, you know, so it's a bit of a crazy idea. It basically came from just spending a lot of time with the patients. Can you guess whose idea it was?
Well, it's an idea that seems a little crazy, a little out there, but it seems actually, when you think about it, grounded in rational science and probably was tested quite well. I'd have to guess at Ramachandran.
That's right. Let me give you the funniest bit of that article. He says, Wernicke's aphasia patients are also able to understand and communicate subtle concepts. When playing chess or checkers with Wernicke's aphasia patients, if the examiner makes an illegal cheating move, the patients invariably give a look of disbelief or anger to the examiner or wave their hands in objection, though they do not possess sufficient language ability to complain verbally. And I think that's just like Ramachandran. Cheat at chess with someone with brain damage just to prove a point.
Pulling the coffee cup away from someone's phantom limb. It's just like, beat your chest.
I think it's a bit like Andy Kaufman. I don't know how much you know about Andy Kaufman. He did a men versus women wrestling league and said that he could beat any woman wrestler. Well, you know, I think that's what Ramachandran is. He's the all-star mixed neurologically damaged and neurologist league chess champion.
I'd watch that.
So yeah, to conclude on Wernicke, and this is why I was being a bit weirded out by Ben's fate. Do you know how Wernicke died?
Was it riding a bike?
He had a bike accident.
Oh no.
So it looks.
Does this mean I'm going to discover a new neurological condition in like the next 2 days?
Good luck with that. Yeah, it does. It does. But yeah, okay. That's the end of Wernicke, quite literally.
Yeah. So there we go. I mean, these two studies are often paired together in lectures and books and things because they kind of lead on from each other. And they're these classic examples of approaching brain damage in a kind of new scientific way, which was kind of relatively new at the time.
Yeah.
And has formed the foundation of a lot of how we do neuropsychology these days. I say
absolutely.
We.
Scientists. Well, I suppose you are a scientist.
The people who don't work in social psychology. they're really interesting studies. They've got a lot of weirdness about them, and we thought they were fascinating when we first came across
them. They demonstrate this localization of brain function, and language does take up actually a large proportion of the human brain because it's quite complicated, and we'll have to come back to it because it's really interesting.
There's an awful lot of cool stuff you can say about
Wernicke. Wernicke is coming to this key point, this idea that words themselves are inside our head. I think that's my favourite bit of it. I mean, the Broca stuff is cool, and Tan, obviously, we feel very fondly towards him, even if he's a much less pleasant person than someone like Patient HM, who we also obviously love a lot.
He made our lectures on this stuff particularly kind of bearable.
I seem to remember
Patient Tan.
Every single photograph that appeared in your lecture notes, you would draw a speech bubble and the word Tan coming out, no matter who they were. Obviously, you started with LeBourne, but then it was just like anyone.
Or thing, animal, inanimate object with face drawn on it. Yeah.
I should have drawn it on your face.
Oh, thank you, notes. I should get a tattoo, just like a speech bubble with Tan smirking from the corner of your mouth.
Yeah, make sure it's the appropriate contralateral side.
Neurophysiologically accurate tattoos.
Yeah.
And on that note, unless you have anything else to add, I think we can draw that episode to a close. So next week, we might be doing some brain mythology.
Yep.
That turns out not to be myth. We might be doing some brain mythology that turns out to actually be myth.
Yeah. Apparently, Ben says that serial killers aren't humorous enough.
Tim wanted to do an episode on serial killers. I've just read a book about psychopaths. He wanted to do an episode about psychopaths.
Yeah, I know. The two aren't the same.
Two specifically aren't the same. I just read a book about them. It's an amazingly good book. If you're in any way interested in like psychological testing and what psychopathy actually is, then read it. It's called The Psychopath Test. It's by the guy whose name escapes me. Who wrote
John Ronson.
John Ronson.
Men Who Stare at Goats as well, didn't he? Men
Who Stare at Goats, which made him the film. But the overwhelming emotions that I received from reading this book were not of humor and amusement. It's very well written, but it is mainly kind of sobering and kind of thought-provoking and somewhat distressing in places. But
will you change your mind if I do somewhat jazzy settings of passages from the book, a bit like Mark Ronson's version?
No, I think that would add to the disquiet.
Down, you know. Let's say goodbye before we do anything
I'm
else
shaking
weird.
My head at you. Anyway, yeah, so that's why we're not doing psychopathy. If you'd really like to hear an episode on psychopathy, then give us feedback. Tell us you want to hear it and we'll do it.
Yeah, feedback, yeah. The usual places.
And yeah, so psychomediapodcast@gmail.com and
psychomedia.wordpress.com for the show notes. At Tetrarchangel. You could try adding us on Facebook. Might not work.
Yeah, it'd be probably more likely to get Tim to add you on Facebook. I'm just going to hazard. Obviously,
podcast
I'll be
hussy
dead,
and so an internet hussy.
Probably less effective. If you want to pray or get a Ouija board, like I'd like a chat, that'd be good.
Oh, yeah, because you're going to be dead. Yeah. But if you're on the internet, then you can put it anywhere.
Well, yeah, you can, but, you know, direct line. So, yeah, awesome. Thank you for listening, and goodbye.
Goodbye from the future. That was the Psychomedia podcast, a relic of the internet age, before the dark forces of the Squireites, followers of the Antichrist, rose up and threw down all that was good and worthy. The blessed nuclear fire of the great good ones, heroes of the faith, Buckley and Ramachandran, came down on the foul hordes of Zionists and the unholy whore of Babylon, Sigmund Freud. Today we live in a post-apocalyptic world with one beat-up iPod, listening to the treasures of that age, those few podcasts that remain to us. Come closer to the fire and listen to more of what they discovered about the hilarious brain. We should be safe here from the radiation for a little while.